Hey, Hobie, nice to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you too. How are you doing?
I am doing swell, thanks. I am excited for another month of reviews and perspectives with you.
Coming to you from semi-scenic Loma Linda, California, it's Reviews and Perspectives with Dr. Hobart Lee.
Okay, Hobie, the topic you've picked for this month is helping our overweight and obese patients lose weight. And frankly, Hobie, I can't believe you picked this one because this is so phenomenally complex. There's no way we're going to be able to do it justice in 15 to 20 minutes. This is a massive topic.
Extensively so, because there's so much to talk about. Diet, exercise, medications, comorbid conditions like diabetes or depression, the social stigma that is around obesity. And then we can go back to the science. Is BMI really the best way to calculate obesity and risk in patients? We know it's not. And then what about genetic predisposition or things like abnormal gut microbiomes? It's so complicated.
And we can't talk about obesity without mentioning the fact that so much of the world, particularly North America, is an obesogenic culture. You know, there's the interplay of the social determinants of health, plus high stress levels and low sleep levels and the presence of food deserts and the ubiquitousness of processed cheap food that is nearly, if not totally, devoid of nutritional value. And so many other factors that come together to really create the perfect storm for this epidemic of obesity that we have going on.
Yeah. So as you're talking about this, I'm like feeling the pressure and stress because it's so complicated. And so a patient comes in and says, well, I want to lose weight. It's not just like, okay, well, here's a little tweak we need to make and we can solve this problem. It's very complicated. But let's talk about how we address it with our patients.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to, Hobie, is how do we help the patient in front of us? It's important for us to remember to advocate for societal change, but the heart of family medicine is the patient-physician relationship. So one of the first things I want to find out for my patient is, why do they want to lose weight and what are their goals? Coming up with a realistic, concrete goal improves the chances of accomplishing what the patient hopes to accomplish.
I really struggle, like, what's realistic for these patients? Is 5% weight loss appropriate, 5% of their total body weight, or 10%, or 15 to 20%? And then the other thing is, most of my patients don't think in percentages, right? I know that studies often quote, oh, the patient lost 5% of their body weight, but patients think in pounds, right? Or kilograms, depending on where you are, but we'll go with pounds. So is 5 pounds enough? Is 10 pounds enough? Is 15 pounds enough? What is significant mean to the patient? One of the things that's clear is like BMI depends on your height and weight. But roughly, if you take the average height of a person in the United States, you know, about 7 pounds is equal to 1 point on their BMI. And so if you want to move somebody from obesity, like let's say their BMI is right around 30 and you want to kind of get them to normal weight, we're really talking about a weight loss of 35 pounds or more, right? To really make that big change.
Yeah, that's a lot of weight. And that number of losing 30, 40, 50, 60 pounds can seem incredibly daunting to some of our patients, probably most of our patients. So part of what we can do is go over the health benefits of losing even a smaller amount of weight, like 3% or 5% of your body weight will help improve your blood pressure, help improve knee pain from your osteoarthritis. It will help with depression if your body's finally able to exercise more and you can chase your kids around at the park. Small amounts of weight loss have benefits that extend far beyond any number you see on a scale.
Yeah, so that's so true. Weight is a number. It's one number, and it is not the best number to indicate someone's fitness, someone's health overall. But let's talk about diet, because I do think that's one key piece when we talk about counseling. How do you counsel your patients about changing their diet when they're trying to lose weight?
In terms of diet, I can offer a certain amount of advice, but I do like to connect my patients with people who have more understanding and training in this. So a dietitian, if that's something my patients are willing to explore or able to explore. But in terms of what we talk about in the office, I've learned an awful lot from Dr. Yoni Friedhoff. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he is kind of a guru in weight management at the family practice level.
Nice.
And the first principle I go over with my patients is that any dietary changes need to be sustainable. They have to like what they're doing. Because if you go on the cabbage soup diet, you're probably not going to want to eat cabbage soup for the rest of your life.
That's right. So
any change needs to be doable for the long haul. And another recommendation is to go for the low-hanging fruit first. I think a lot of people come in and be like, oh, okay, so I need to do paleo, or I need to do intermittent fasting, or I need to like have no carbs.
Yes.
Where in reality, there are some small changes they can do that may have a big impact. Like if they like double cream, double sugar, as we call a double-double up here in their coffee, well, they can work at cutting that back.
Yes.
Or if they're a big fan of juice, maybe they can switch to water. So we go for the low-hanging fruit first.
Yeah, I love that. And I'll just say, as an American who has visited Canada several times, I love Tim Hortons. It's very hard for me to pass up getting some donuts and coffee at Tim Hortons when I'm there. So I will fully admit, I'm somebody who needs to avoid the double-double, as you call it. But I love the part where you talk about the diet that they'll do is the most successful one. They might say, well, I want to be vegan, no carbs, and all this other stuff. And I say, great, how can you do that? And they say, I have no idea. Right? Or like, they do it for a day, and they say, wow, this is a lot. And I love that you focused on liquids. You know, one of the things that I remember learning was like, the number one place Americans get empty calories is through the liquids they drink. We drink a lot of sugar-sweetened beverages, whether that's juice or soda or coffee with cream and sugar, right? We just love these really high calorie drinks that don't really provide any nutrition. And so simply cutting out those kind of drinks could be hugely beneficial in terms of reducing the number of calories a patient takes in during a day. So often when patients are really lost, I just say, let's just review what you drink in a day.
Yeah.
And if you replace some of that with just water, often they are able to get a net negative caloric intake.
Yeah, and that's a good idea to actually review what a patient is eating in a day and getting them to track what they're eating and bringing that back to review with them at a future visit. That can be helpful too.
Yeah, and I think there's good data that even a 24-hour food diary recall is like really good evidence. If you just, as a patient's waiting for you, if you know they're here for weight loss issues, have your medical assistant or nurse give them a piece of paper and say, just write down everything you've eaten and drank in the last 24 hours. And often that gives you as a physician a lot of information about the types of foods they're eating, fast foods versus processed foods versus, you know, when they're eating and those types of things.
Yeah, a food diary is a great idea. And it can stimulate further discussions on what healthy eating can look like. And when we get into these discussions, I often find that my patients want me to recommend a very specific diet for them, or at least to hear my thoughts on it, like volume eating or paleo or intermittent fasting or low-carb diet. And while I do try pretty hard to stay abreast of what's going on in the eating and diet world, I'm always hesitant to recommend a specific quote-unquote diet plan. And instead, I do endorse eating, you know, lots of fruits and vegetables and whole grains and lean proteins. And if my patients have questions beyond that, again, I do like to get a dietitian involved whenever possible. When my patients come in to talk about weight loss, they always want to talk about exercise and what kind of a role that can play in weight loss. And I heard a saying several years ago that's really stuck with me. It says, lose weight in the kitchen, get fit in the gym. So I would like to say that exercise contributes very significantly to weight loss. It doesn't as much as our patients would like it to. But that being said, exercise is part of an overall healthy lifestyle. So Hobie, how do you talk to your patients about this topic?
Yeah, I had not heard that phrase before, but I love that, right? Because actually the data would really back that up. When you change your diet, what you eat, it's much easier to lose weight than by simply just increasing exercise or physical activity. But, and I'm sure our listeners here would have a lot of comments on exercise and nutrition and physical activity. So I would love to read some of those if people want to post stuff up or send comments in. I think that would be awesome. But I know we often quote 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise as kind of like the goal for our patients, right? We say, oh, 150 minutes, moderate intensity. But I often think about the blue zones, and the blue zones are places in the world where people live to be over 100 routinely, right? So these are places where people have just fairly long lives. And one of these places is in Okinawa, Japan. And there are particularly a group of elderly women who have really great health outcomes there. They do have a close-knit community, which is really 100% vital in sort of these blue zones. But if you ask them if they exercise, they say, no, I don't exercise. But if you watch them, they are constantly moving. Many of them grow their own food. So they have gardens and they're getting in the dirt and they're planting stuff and they're weeding. They prepare all their own food. So they're in their kitchen moving around. And in Japan, they don't sit in chairs and eat at tables. They have these low tables where they have to sit on the ground. And so you actually sit on a cushion and you eat off a table that's kind of almost like coffee table height in the United States or lower. And so they're constantly getting up and sitting down, getting up and sitting down, getting up and sitting down. And so this constant movement is physical activity. They're not exercising, as we would say in quotations here, but they are moving a lot. And I've heard this idea of exercise snacking. So we talk about snacking and when we eat, right, these short snippets of food that we might eat. Can we do that with exercise? So a lot of my patients say, well, I can't afford a gym membership. I don't have time in my day to go for an hour to the gym and work out. But I ask them, okay, well, tell me, do you have 5 minutes? Do you have 10 minutes in your day? Could you take the stairs instead of the elevator into your office? Could you park far away from the store and walk an extra quarter mile into the store that you're trying to get into? And when you schedule meetings with your coworkers or your friends, could you walk when you're watching TV? I know in streaming, there are no more commercials, but when there were commercials, I'd often tell patients, can you walk in place or do some jumping jacks during the commercials?
Yeah.
You don't care what's happening during the commercials anyways, right? And so all that movement counts. There is some data that as little as 10 minutes, if you can do multiple sessions a day, that might be enough to promote weight loss and being more healthy.
Wow, weight loss. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
10 minutes a day. Huh. I will continue to weed the garden on my way to my car in the mornings before I go to work. So.
Well, it's multiple 10 minutes, right? So not just 10 minutes.
Shoot! But, yes.
I thought we had something here.
Let's not mislead people here. In this study, they did 10 minutes four times a day. So it was 40 minutes, but it was not 40 minutes all at once. It was 10 minutes four times a day. But I think that might be easier for people to swallow. Because if you say, look, I don't have 40 minutes, but if you say, do you have 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes at noon, 10 minutes after work, and 10 minutes before you go to bed, people might say, well, yeah, maybe I could do something like that. And they can build up to it. So it's not something even they have to do all at once, right? You say, start with 10 minutes, then add another 10 minutes, and then add another 10 minutes. So I think those are some of the strategies, I think, for all of us when we kind of get stuck with patients. There are other ways to maybe approach the idea of physical activity.
Okay, Hobie, so we have the patient who, you know, is motivated to try dietary changes, to try exercise, but so many of our patients are frustrated. They've tried that, and now they're ready for something else, and they come to us looking for medication.
Yes.
Do you prescribe weight loss drugs?
I don't, but I'll say that may be changing, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but I've been one of those, I don't prescribe those drugs. You know, my feeling has been to date that weight loss drugs on the market have very minimal impact. Meaning like the weight loss that's really seen in the trials is small. It's 5 pounds. It's 10 pounds. It's not something that patients are going to say, oh, well, that's what I was looking for.
Right.
And these drugs are not meant to be taken long term. So there's not long term safety data on these drugs. And to me, that bothered me. And some of these drugs have really nasty side effects. Sibutramine, it's off the market now, but when it was on the market, it increased your risk of MI and stroke. And so I just thought, I don't know, if I'm the do no harm first to my patients, right? It didn't feel right to me to give them a medication, which I understood they wanted to lose the weight. I don't think most patients would trade that for a heart attack or a stroke. That didn't seem like a fair risk-benefit profile. And so I had a faculty tell me once that they were prescribing these medications, but they stopped because they felt like it was teaching the patients the wrong thing. It was that you could eat your cookies and still lose the weight. And that inevitably, all these patients had to come off of these medications for one reason or another. But they were still eating the cookie. And so what ended up happening is that weight loss ended up all coming back. And a lot of them ended up heavier than they started. I don't know. What about you? Do you prescribe these medications?
Kind of like you, I'm coming around to them. So the bigger barrier where I practice is the cost of these medications. Like most patients wouldn't have coverage for them. Mm-hmm. But for patients who do, and for patients who are kind of approaching weight loss from a holistic point of view, I do prescribe it as part of that. But with the understanding that these medications, once you stop them, the weight can come back unless these other pieces are in place.
Yeah.
While we're both late adopters here of weight loss drugs, Hobie, I think we can say that semaglutide, the once weekly injectable GLP-1 agonist, it's been kind of impressive. And by impressive, I mean a 34-pound weight loss in a year. It does stand out.
Yeah. So when I saw this study, I was surprised by how much weight they've lost. Because like I said before, all the other trials with weight loss drugs, 5, 10, 15 pounds, something. And I just thought, most of my patients are going to say, that's it. That's not what I'm talking about. If I told a patient, well, this new drug, you can lose 34 pounds in a year. I think a lot of my patients would say, that's what I'm talking about.
Yep.
That's what I need. And they lost 12% more than the placebo group, which is, I think, a pretty robust difference. The semaglutide was an addition to lifestyle changes. So let's not forget it was just like they were getting a weekly injection, but they were engaged in all the stuff that we've been talking about before. And they did have a lot of GI side effects like nausea and diarrhea. So that is a concern. The other thing I would say that gives me some pause is the study was for a little over a year. I think it was around 68 weeks or so that they studied this medication. So we don't have long-term data. We don't have long-term safety data. Although this medicine has been used for a while in diabetics. And so we do have some extrapolated data. But the two keys here were the dose used in this trial was much higher than what we use for diabetics. So it's a higher dose. And it's really expensive.
Yes. Yeah, the price does remain a barrier. But I do have to say, I am not hesitating to prescribe this medication for my diabetic patients who need to improve their glycemic control and would like to lose a little bit of weight.
Let's talk about one more thing, bariatric surgery. I think that can be very effective for the right patient. The patient selection is so important, which is why I think bariatric surgeons are recognizing that many of their patients who get the surgery gain the weight back because, again, the underlying issues have not been solved or resolved. It's one of the reasons why I think a lot of these bariatric surgery programs have these very intensive pre-surgery requirements now. 6 months of counseling, 6 months of weight loss, 6 months of all these changes, because the surgery alone is not going to fix everything for them.
Yeah, and why follow-up is so important for our bariatric surgery patients. And it's just humbling to me to think of bariatric surgery patients who then go on to regain the weight and just makes me feel like, well, what's the average? If even our bariatric surgery patients regain weight, what hope does everybody else have?
It just shows it's complicated.
Yeah.
It's so complicated. One surgery is not going to fix it. One medicine is not going to fix it. One nutritional change is not going to fix it.
Yeah.
There's a reason why we have an obesity epidemic.
Yeah.
There's a reason why we haven't fixed it. It's not easy.
Sure, it's in part a personal issue, but it's societal.
Yes, 100%. As long as the fast food burger is cheaper than buying fresh fruits and vegetables in the grocery store, a lot of my patients are going to choose the fast food burger.
Yep.
If going to this grocery store and buying fresh fruits and vegetables destroys your monthly budget, how will you do that?
Right. And if you are so sleep deprived because you have to work two jobs to put food on the table for your kids,
that's
of course you're going to eat the junk food just because it makes you feel good. And it's probably the only one you can afford from working your two low paying jobs to put food on the table.
So I think you and I have just highlighted part of that societal pressure, right? And this is what we have to push against. We have to change that at a larger, broad scale level, at a public health level, at a governmental level. We have to address those issues. But I would say that is part of the challenge when we work with patients one-on-one in the office, right? We haven't changed those rules yet. So those things still all exist for our patients. And we are kind of pushing against that. And that's what's so hard, right? Is that there are so many societal influences that actually make this job a lot harder for the patients to achieve.
It sure is.
Recap.
How would you summarize our discussions on obesity and weight loss?
It's really complicated.
Yes.
Very, very hard. I think this was like therapy for the last 20 minutes for you and me, because all we were doing was talking about, oh, well, yes, we could do this, but, oh, yes, we would do this, but, like, there's so many buts here. It's so challenging. But I think we also recognize the scope of the problem. Like, almost, you know, 2/3 of people in the United States are overweight or obese, and there are pockets where that's even higher in our country. And so, like, it's a real problem. And I think we as primary care physicians, being the point of contact, having these continuity relationships with our patients, really have an opportunity to address this and, again, push back against some of what they're feeling in society.
Yeah, and we do have that ongoing partnership with our patients so we can continue to work with them. We can focus on nutrition and exercise and talk to them about medications like semaglutide, even if we're not sure that it's ready for prime time.
Yeah. And the biggest question I have around this whole topic, is it semaglutide or is it semiglutide? Because I've heard it pronounced both ways. And I have not yet heard a definitive answer about what the correct way to pronounce this medication.
Stay tuned for next month's Reviews and Perspectives with Hobart Lee, where for 20 minutes, we debate how to pronounce a generic drug.
I don't want to miss any of it.